Welcome to Just an Average Citizen, the podcast that helps to educate, inform, and empower you to make an impact in Abilene and the Big Country. I'm so excited you've joined me today for this episode. This is called Our Book by the Bite, because I believe that we should all be reading more, but sometimes our schedule doesn't allow for us to, or we just haven't gotten into the rhythm where we can. And so I want to give you some bites of some books that I've been reading or have felt that have made a great impact and are worth sharing with you, so that maybe you can put them on a list of books you would like to read. I try to cover a lot of different topics, from faith to freedom and family and all those things in between, because I think it matters here. And this is where I do share more of my opinions about certain topics and certain issues. So the Monday podcast is more about just what's going on in the city government and observations I have, but not too much editorial stuff. But here, 100% editorial, because I have to have opinions to be able to talk about good and relevant cultural topics that we are battling even here in Abilene in the Big Country. So please subscribe and share this podcast with your friends and family, because I think these are conversations we need to learn how to start having, because just not talking about these things doesn't make it go away. And it's, you know, this whole process has been a journey for me, because this is not really where I saw myself leading or going. And I know we haven't quite picked up steam, but I know that once things hit the fan, so to speak, whatever it is, whether it's in our city or in our world or our nation, people need to have a reliable source of information where they know that it's been researched and the truth is told as best as humanly possible, with mistakes along the way. But we have to know where we can connect and understand what's going on in today's age without really having that opportunity through many mainstream things that are easily accessible. And so that's what this podcast is about. But I'm really excited about this one. You know, I pray and ask the Lord to show me what book is best, because I could stay really in one topic for a long time. But, you know, we have to kind of keep ourselves knowing all the different players of the system. And this book came up next, probably back in December or before that. And so I was preparing to do this, and in preparation for this, things happened and timelines changed. And now I've even changed to some degree what we're going to talk about for this particular book. So I started off wanting to really explain to you the book In Order to Live, A North Korean Girl's Journey to Freedom by Yeonomi Park. I think that's how you say her name. Every time I say her name, I think of the way her dad called her in the book. And so that helps me remember the accent, because we would probably say it a little differently. So I hope I'm honoring that. And when I started getting ready to record this podcast, I realized that actually she wrote a second book, a more current book, and it is called While Time Remains, and it's a search for freedom. It's a North Korean defector's search for freedom in America. And so I think there was maybe 5 years difference between these two books. And so this is the book we're going to be talking about today. I'm going to bring in a little bit of the other one, because I think it's key and important, and she doesn't discuss it in the same detail. So I'm hoping to fly through some of these slides. You know, it's a work in progress trying to understand how can you talk to somebody about a book without me looking at notes and engaging with you like I would like to if we were sitting over a cup of coffee, because that's how I really like to do things. Although the older I get, the less I get to drink coffee throughout the day as much as I would like to. But we would sit over and have a drink and talk about these relevant issues, because we don't get to understand what we're really made of and what we really believe until we expose those ideas to someone possibly criticizing it or challenging it or questioning it. And it's through that process that we learn what really will hold true. And so that's why I welcome engaging with people who don't agree with me, because it helps me to understand where have I not really thought through what I believe, and where are some places that are really strongly tethered to the Word of God and who He says I am and what He says about our world. And so to me, I love these kind of conversations. Of course, I know I'm wired for it. You would ask my husband, and he does not like these conversations. And so we, you know, work together to draw out in others what maybe they don't carry, and then they can help draw out in us what we don't carry. And there's a balance between all walks of life, all types of personalities. We can't all be like me, and we can't all be like those who don't want to say every thought in their brain, although I'm getting better at not doing that. So anyway, I'm really excited to talk to you about this book. There, you know, I have found that I don't have to agree with everything to make a book quality reading or a really strong story or helpful information, but there are some things that we do hold near and dear to our heart, and we have to find that common ground. And so what's fun is then when I don't agree with everything, I have to go, well, why don't I agree with that? And then it really helps me to understand what I believe and give me words to express and articulate what it is, rather than just feeling like I have nothing to say when the opportunity arrives. It arises for me to be able to explain myself. So While Time Remains is a great book, and she speaks on so many things that I have been talking to people about left and right these days, it seems. And so it's just really fun when you get a little, hey, maybe you're not off in the weeds as you think you are sometimes. Maybe you're flying right over the target. So let's go through these quickly. So I have a lot more pictures than I'm really going to share with you, but I just need some triggers to help me remember. And this is the best thing. So the forward to her book is by Jordan Peterson. And so let me give you a little background here before I actually get started with the book. So this young lady, her family generationally has lived in North Korea for generations. Her parents were born into a fairly decent level, even though, because there's very much a caste system in North Korea, even though they weren't at the top, they weren't at the bottom, and they were able to live quite well in these conditions compared to most. And when I say quite well, she talks about this, you know, I mean, to eat two meals a day was considered extravagant. Like, you just sacrificed the third meal because you were a good citizen. So it's not like we're talking like they lived in opulence. I mean, I would still say in abject poverty. They didn't have electricity. They didn't have running water. They didn't have a lot of these things that most of us take for granted. And so that they lived well in that condition is saying a lot. And then her dad was arrested for participating in an underground market, which was how people survived. And once he was arrested, then they were thrown down in the caste system and starving. She had an older sister. And her older sister decided that the only way to survive was to be trafficked into China. And they thought it was the land of opulence. They thought it was the land of extravagance. They've seen, you know, pirated or bootlegged or illegal movies or TV shows that they'd watched. So they really had an impression of China and thought it was going to be better. And I love one of the things that that's what her dad calls it. You know me. Park says is that her only goal in leaving North Korea was just to have a bowl of rice. And like, I can almost just kind of weep over that, because that is just such a low level of expectation for what life means. And so she just wanted a bowl of rice, and instead she was human trafficked by multiple men in multiple circumstances. She was sold multiple times in various ways, and was able to eventually, once she was in China, find her, be given freedom, so to speak, so that she could connect with some missionaries in China, who weren't even from China, and they helped her and her a group of eight cross the Gobi, is that right? The Gobi Desert, and almost died in the process, and were willing to kill themselves that they were captured or sent back to China, which is a really hard decision as a she was 16 by that time, to have to make that decision as a 16-year-old. I mean, that's not the weight of what a 16-year-old should have to do anyway. So they were able to get into South Korea and learn what they hadn't known most of their life. And eventually she became a spokesperson for those who are suffering in North Korea. And that was her only goal. She was reconnected with her sister. I guess she was about 20. And her father died in China from colon cancer. And now she ended up moving and gaining citizenship in America, which she never, ever thought would be possible. Never even had it on her radar. And so it's a really beautiful story. So that kind of catches us up to, I mean, and again, the first book, In Order to Live, there are so many times I just wanted to weep. And I read this with my children, and it's like, there's a level of evil that we in America just cannot fathom, because that's not the way our society is founded. I mean, and we'll talk about this a little bit more, but the way there are some people being treated subhuman, and it's really sobering. So if you want to really learn to appreciate and value the difference between a constitutional republic and what a communist nation looks like, that so many people just speak about in terms of a utopia where everybody gets equally treated, you can find the horrors that have come out of every single communist country in the world throughout history of time. There is no socialist or communist country that can succeed based on that principle alone, because eventually equality equity is destructive and will ruin any good. It just, it becomes evil. And it's because humans are depraved and we are unable to change who we are except by the grace of God. And when we put people in power who do not have a relationship or do not have accountability to God, they really have great propensity to destroy and kill millions of people, like we'll learn about in the story. So this is her autobiography. And again, she doesn't do this because she likes being on the stage, but she knows she's been given a gift. And for her not to be very intentional in making sure other people know what is going on to the people who remain in North Korea to this day, she says she just couldn't, she couldn't really live with herself if she didn't do everything she could to resolve that. So, all right. So let's now get started with the book. Jordan Peterson is the one who gives her foreword. And really, at the end of the book, she talks about how he was instrumental in helping her understand even what she needed to do as a human being to step out of that trauma and bring healing to herself. And I appreciate this comment he made. He said, she encountered the same ideology that has corrupted her homeland and doomed its inhabitants to a life in hell. Of course, it was America. It was totalitarianism light offered as all such things are in this overcoddled and narcissistic time as a convenient fashion statement, a faux identity, a means of parading unearned moral virtue while bidding time as an oppressor in training the inevitable and truly desired fate of every virtue signaling Ivy League graduate. So here's this lady that came from North Korea. And when she entered into Columbia University, he said she encountered the same ideology that corrupted her homeland in a university here in America. And totalitarianism light. Totalitarianism is a very destructive and demonic governing body. It silences those who stand in opposition and creates such a paralyzing, crippling society that no one can thrive. You know, and it's even funny, like we're even battling to some of this here in Abilene. You know, we have a university that is battling with what does it mean to live and operate, sorry, not live, but operate as a biblical founded, a university founded in biblical principles and a biblical worldview. And we have students who are saying their right to exist is being threatened because not everyone on that university agrees with their choices they're making. Their right to exist is being threatened. They can't exist in Abilene, Texas, as who they want to be because people don't agree with them. Talk about a faux identity, parading unearned moral virtue. Like, it is very relevant for what is going on even here in the big country, is that we have young men and women who don't understand that your identity is not based on the approval of someone else. So moving on. Okay. So I love this. When she escaped into North Korea, into China on March 30th, 2007, she didn't escape in search of freedom or liberty or safety. She escaped in search of a bowl of rice. She was so hungry. They used to eat food to make their stomachs feel full so the gnawing hunger wouldn't overwhelm them, especially during school. Can you imagine a poor child starving? A lot of the struggles she had, she actually was hospitalized because she had a malnutrition issue. And she said most doctors could instantly recognize it, but the medical care there was so poor that they thought it was appendicitis and tried to take out her appendix. With anesthesia, she had to pay for herself. I mean, you can't even afford to eat. How are you going to pay for medical anesthesia? She woke up during her surgery and they had to pay her bill before they would take the stitches out. I mean, like, it's just horrendous. She said, but now looking back on it from a distance, nearly half my life from my apartment in Chicago, the part of my life gave me appreciation for a simple human existence that I'm not sure I would have gotten anywhere else. Again, we don't have to look at our suffering and think, why me? But we look at our suffering and think, what has it taught me? And who am I? Who am I because of that? And again, I think she has the extreme of all extremes. But here in our cush society in America, where we're so coddled, like Peterson said, or so coddled, can we look at even our mild suffering and recognize that we can learn things from it and we don't have to be identified from it, but it can propel us into greater things? I mean, that's what the Bible talks about, you know, that just because we suffer, it doesn't mean that that's who we are. I mean, that's not exactly what the Bible says, but I mean, saying our identity is not in our circumstances. Our identity is who God says we are. She says, I feel a deep appreciation and awe for human freedom as a whole, the right to exist, the ability to think, to love, to walk, or sit without even looking over my shoulder, to take two consecutive breaths uninterrupted by fear. We don't know that here in America. We don't. You think you might. You think there might be people who do. Now, maybe people who've come into America, but if you are a native-born American, you don't understand that fear in the least. The Chinese Communist Party has long since replaced the USSR as a chief enabler of the modern-day Holocaust. That should sober you, because we're talking of millions of lives who have died under the communist regime, and yet we have people who are promoting these things. I mean, I know there are pictures of Mao, is that right? How do you say his name? In restaurants here in America, because they celebrate him, because they think he's a, you know, he is one of the most evil men who's existed on the earth because of the amount of people he's killed, but yet he's allowed to be celebrated in America. Many of my fellow Americans have lost the ability to appreciate the glory of this country the way I do. And the second, that many of them are not able to recognize certain threats. So she sees threats in our country that she recognizes because of where she's come from, that we as Americans, unless we're willing to look and study and recognize the sign of the times, we will not recognize them. And so many people, you know, got frustrated with me for standing up over a statue because it didn't seem like that big of a deal. I feel in a small way that I'm recognizing the signs of the times, and most people don't want to believe that it's really as nefarious as it is. But we are getting to that place, people, and we can no longer sit by. And that's why I'm bringing in relevant things that are happening in our city. Again, are they, is it to the level of a Holocaust? No, but if we don't stop these things early on, there will be a time where we have no power to do anything about it. Right wing is one of those terms of abuse I understood only after a number of my fellow Americans used it in concerted and sometimes successful attempts to harass and censor me. It means right wing, by this definition, see, we have to define our terms. It means disloyal to the taste, opinions, values, and preferences of the financial, political, and cultural elite. The disloyalty of the lower and working classes to the ruling class. Did you know we have a ruling class? We do. They're alive and well. What I am committed to is an absolutist ideology of individual rights and freedom, the kind that Thomas Jefferson and Martin Luther King Jr. shared in common. And I love that in our nation, there is a thread that goes through our history of people who stood for these rights and freedom, and that connects us. And even last week, I saw in New York City, they took down a statue of Thomas Jefferson. And we are allowing people to destroy that connecting thread, because once that's gone, we will be no longer connected. And that's why we have to see what's going on in our time. All right, so I've gotten smart. I've taken pictures of the chapter. And again, I don't like using this word, but it's very predominant in North Korean culture. American Bastards is the introduction. So mass enslavement of population's mental The mass enslavement of a population's mental life is called emotional dictatorship. So you don't have to have just physical, it can be emotional. So as a child, she worried that she would never see her parents again, that the four of us would never be made whole again. And so she had to kind of go numb, feeling a near total indifference to life. And she was only 10 years old when she realized this was the way she was going to have to live. She was a human being alienated from her family and facing I like this part where it says, when you hear stories about the apathy and cruelty that ordinary people find themselves resorting to in socialist systems. So we as Americans cannot look at people who live in socialist systems and really judge them the way we judge ourselves. She says, because a human being alienated from her family and facing starvation has been robbed of her capacity to connect with the world around her. Isolation, separation, you cannot understand how that wounds a person. You know, that's why they have social confinement in jail, because it is debilitating. And they have limits to that, because they understand if you do not have human connection in a significant way, then you're it's devastating to you emotionally and physically. So again, this is when she's referring to when she had to cross the Gobi Desert to hopefully find freedom, unknowing if she'd find freedom. Ever since I thought of the Gobi Desert as my deliverance, my personal Red Sea, I remember the feeling of looking up at the sky on the night we spent tracking across the desert A dumbstruck awe accompanied by an intense loneliness and feeling of utter insignificance. I recall thinking that if I died that night of frostbite or of an affliction or by falling prey to wild animals, that ultimately, once my mother was gone, no one would even know or care. And that was a really sobering thought when she walked across the desert and she didn't know if anybody would miss her besides her mother. And that makes you feel so small. And I love that God did not leave her in that place. And I don't know where she is in her faith journey. I know she's been exposed to the heart of God, and I don't know how she's actively pursuing that. She did a good job of not really addressing it in this, in either of the books necessarily. But I thought, how many of us feel like no one even would miss us? I mean, we know suicide rates are up. We know people are hopeless in these times, and we have, and that's because of the isolation and the inability to have conversations with people that awaken in us the humanity that we long to connect with. And so that is why I try to really press hard that we need each other, and we cannot stop talking about hard things, because that's when we start emotionally cutting off and have no ability to recognize that we have value and worth within our community. But if we're not willing to do the hard, we deprive ourselves of the good. Oh, so when she looked up at the sky, she said, all the things that they did in the port, and again, the horrific sex trafficking that goes on in China with these poor North Koreans who are just hungry. And it continues to this day. She said she was reflecting on this, how all of it would have been meaningless unless I could find a way to give it meaning. I promised myself that night if I made it to the other side, if I survived, I would have to find a way to give it all meaning to Inumi is her sister's disappearance, because they hadn't found her at that point, to her mother's abuse that she endured all along the way to protect her daughter, to my father's imprisonment and death. I had to live in order to tell my story and the story of 21 million North Koreans still trapped in the darkest places of the earth. And you know, it's so amazing. The grief that I'm feeling right now is not even just for the North Koreans, but there's so many people trapped in this darkness. And this is just highlighting one nation in the world that has hurting people that you'll see have been completely neglected and looked over because of the power of the people, because of the people in power and their unwillingness to do the right thing. So when they were getting ready to cross the border, like I said, they were preparing for their suicide if they were required to go back to China. They even said, listen, if you take us back to China, we're gonna kill ourselves. She said they tried to lighten the emotional burden by reassuring each other that we were lucky to be in such a position at all, to finally escape to freedom, or else to be finally released from hell. Not a choice you want to be in. She knew. It talks about 70% of North Korean women and teenage girls are being victimized in China, sometimes sold as for as little as $200. And this is when she went and spoke at a big conference. And she knew that once she spoke, and I believe it was in Dublin, where she got up and just told her story. And she said she knew that she crossed an invisible line. That scared, hungry, frightened little girl who hid her innermost thoughts, even from the birds and mice, was gone. I had to close the book on her and step into a life, one dedicated to human rights and improving the lives of the people suffering under tyranny, a life of meaning, a life that would make my father proud. So one of the things her mother would say when she would go to school, she said most mothers would be like, hey, I hope you have a great day. Her mother would always tell her when she went to school in North Korea, it's like, remember the mice and the birds are listening. Because they couldn't talk, because there was always someone willing to turn them in to gain power and advantage in a society that rewarded those who exposed anyone who did not participate in groupthink. And so part one, so now we're to part one, the United States of Confusion. And she moved to New York City. Chapter one is about Lost in the Big Apple. And so I just mentioned about her. She actually had a speech in Dublin where the One World Conference, and it went viral. She was asked by the UN Watch, a nonprofit organization, to address the United Nations 30th Human Rights Council. Can you believe that? How deplorable that UN is to justify all this human suffering, and she got to go and tell her story. And she said by this point, the regime had started spreading rumors about her. Her family was required, that was still left, you know, because they have lots of extended family, to required to denounce her and say vile things about her that weren't true, because, you know, in order to live and survive. So now she's going to start talking a little bit about what happened in North Korea and how they got to this place. And so she mentions that a daily meal of meat and soup and boiled rice was what Kim Il-sung had promised during the revolution. For this modest guarantee, Koreans ceded their rights and property to him for a daily meal of meat, soup, and boiled rice. 75 years later, rice and stew is still a common dying wish for North Koreans. It was one of my father's. So they traded it. It reminds you of the story of Jacob and Esau, traded his birthright for a bowl of stew. In North Korea, thankfully Esau had a better outcome, I believe, in the end, but in North Korea, cows have more rights than people. The lack of private property rights means cows belong not to ranchers, but to the regime. Even many cattle ranchers who help raise and tend them are not allowed to eat the meat, which is reserved only for government elites. So she was eating a steak and everybody's like, no, it's not healthy for you. You can't do this. She's like, with every bite I took, I felt like I was raising the middle finger to the North Korean regime. She loves steak. And I love that. You know, what was so offensive to so many people in America, she was like, I don't care. I'm going to do this in honor of how many people have suffered because of that regime. And okay, so in many places in the third world, in fact, obesity is a status symbol. It indicates wealth and abundance. It's the equivalent of driving a Lamborghini down Park Avenue. But in the United States, everybody wanted to look skinny, like a starving North Koreans. So here she has been starving her whole life. She comes to America where everyone's trying to watch their weight and lose weight and all the stuff. And she's like, it just makes no sense because overweight is a status symbol. And in fact, you know, she finally realized, you know, one of the leaders was fat. He wasn't starving, even though he told his countrymen, I'm starving for you. But he had a good little sized belly there. There are no words in North Korean. This is amazing. The whole book talks a lot about this. There's no words for love except for love for your leader, the dictator. There are no words in North Korean for tyranny, trauma, or depression, or love for that matter. Without words to describe an emotion or phenomenon, I discovered it's easy enough to live your life not knowing they exist. Totalitarian regimes understand this fact quite well. So if they keep you from the truth, then you don't even know that you don't even know what you don't even know. Finance in America was like food, fitness, and beauty a world away. Listening to people passionately discuss investment ideas or the latest Wall Street developments was like trying to follow a conversation in Martian. She had no grid for what she experienced in America. So now back in North Korea, she says, looking back, it was an interesting social science experiment. What happens when you take a 21-year-old blank slate to all concepts of race and racism are completely foreign and drop her in New York City? From where I sat, America seemed to be the melting pot of legend, all different types of people living, working, interacting, loving, and just existing side by side. It was beautiful, but this was to be the beginning of a long and difficult education. So she decided that she loved New York, she wanted to stay there, and she enrolled in Columbia. And so she said that during my early months in America, she says, one thing that stood out to me instead during my early months in America was the compassion and inclusiveness that people showed towards those with disability. She said, in the regime, shamed people with the term sickened body and relegated them to the countryside to starve. The authorities would also regularly detain people with congenital conditions like dwarfism, put them in camps, and sterilize them to filter out the gene pool. And we're talking like the 1990s people, and maybe even currently today, I don't know. We're not talking like 100 years ago. I mean, it's crazy that this was going on. She said, in China, you know, they, I may talk about that in a minute, so I'll wait. Sometimes I get ahead of myself. So now we're at a chapter 2, the fall of Lady Columbia. So Columbia is one of the few institutions in America that is older than the country itself. Established in 1754, it predates the Declaration of Independence by 22 years and the Constitution by 33. It was originally called King's College, established by a royal charter under King George II and housed on the grounds of Trinity Church. So I love this part because I had no idea. She said, Lady Columbia is a national personification of the United States of America, the female counterpart to Uncle Sam. The typical depiction is of a beautiful young woman with outstretched arms or holding a bright torch, lighting the way toward the promised land. I didn't know what Lady Columbia was, so that was informative to me. All Columbia students are required to take the college core classes, a comprehensive liberal arts education designed to cover the full spectrum of history, science, art, and the humanities. It was a dream. Not quite true. It was a dream come not quite true. So her first class, the professor says, Jane Austen books, the professor went on, propagate the idea that women are inferior to men, that only white males are fully involved and capable of higher level thinking, that salvation is only achievable through the dogma of Christianity. She continued by informing us that Austin, like all white writers during the colonial era, supported white supremacy and racism. She ended with a line I'll never forget. This is how we look for his hidden systemic racism and oppression. Hidden. It's all hidden. You can't see it. That's why you're ignorant of it. So, I really love this comparison. She says, as a student, the teacher in Haesan, the teachers, which is North Korea, the teachers often reminded us that you have to look for hidden signs of infiltration by our enemies. American bastards causing stoking and lurking behind all our problems. Food was scarce, the lights went out, and our parents disappeared, all because of the American bastards. You might not see or hear them, but the American bastards were everywhere, perhaps even in the air we breathed. And so, she started getting excited to learn about music, Western classical music. And she says, was everyone objecting to the music itself or to the people who composed it or the term Western or maybe the word music? Who knew? The lecturer called on one of the students to explain why. The student said that white men in Europe and America had silenced and excluded the composers and musicians of color, so it made no sense to refer to Western music or Western canon, only white canon. And I read an amazing book that addresses all of these points, and it's by Heather McDonald, and I can't remember the title, Race Something. Brilliant follow-up, and I probably should have had that. It just literally dawned on me that she talks about why the music and the arts are the way they are, and it's all being destroyed because of this ideology right here. So she said, in a course on human rights, our teacher, a PhD candidate, taught us that because men are inherently violent by nature, toxic masculinity imbues us nearly all, it imbues everyone. And I wasn't supposed to read that quote, and I did it anyway. Toxic Masculinity, a great book by Nancy Piercy. I don't know if I'm going to cover it because there's so many great books to cover, but I tell you what, we've been sold a bill of goods, that's for sure. So she said what she hadn't learned were the nuances and subtleties of gender interactions in a new culture in academia. And these must, in fact, be learned because none of them are intuitive or obvious. You have to learn all the nuances because you can't see them without having that special Gnostic knowledge that is as religious as Christianity itself. It's ridiculous. And I mean, you can be a Gnostic in any kind of religion or any kind of dogma. You can push it and say you have that special knowledge. That's all Gnosticism is I know more than you. I think I've said I know something you don't know. That's probably a little simplistic. But anyway, we had to be diligent in being woke, learning to locate the white male bastards behind every crime. Do you see how she twisted that? In North Korea, they were American. In America, they're white males. They're beneath every problem in the air we breathe. Otherwise, we are no better than those who intentionally perpetuate social justice injustices. So I love the timing of how God ordains our steps. And I didn't plan this. And you may not be like, it's not matching up. Of course, you're talking about the same thing. But we just talked about how cosmic justice, that's called social justice, it is impossible to maintain, live out, or even fulfill. And here we are that they're saying it's, you know, the white males are behind every one of these injustices, and there's nothing new under the sun. There's nothing new under the sun. Okay. So this is when she's talking about math, and she's saying how they use math to in Colombia. Well, this is in North Korea. They're talking about how they teach math in North Korea. She said, one person plus one person does not equal 22 people. One person plus one person does not equal two people. 21 million people do not make society. In North Korea, the only number is one. One leader followed by one people. Isn't that interesting? Oh, we were taught that a gender is a societal construct imposed by white men, that science and math were also invented by white men to further the agenda of white supremacy, that the goal of technology was not the improvement of life or to push the limits of human knowledge and abilities for its own sake, but as a means of imprisoning the masses by elites, and that Christianity, a religion born in the Middle East desert, was the religion of white people used for no other purpose than to indoctrinate the indigenous tribes they conquered through the use of technology. In the truest sign of stupidity, smallpox wasn't mentioned. How could one of the leading universities in the greatest country in the world teach its students to hate their fellow countrymen? What is the motive behind this destructive narrative? Isn't American universities' mission to train analytical minded individuals capable of civility, constructive social interaction, and open discourse? She was not prepared for what Columbia had in store for her. And again, it's really heavy in the beginning and then we pick up. So don't feel like this is going to go on as long as it is for each chapter, because we're at chapter 3, The Illusion of Safe Spaces. This wildly unnatural arrangement made sense in the earliest part of the 20th century. She's talking about contemporary classrooms. Because young people really did need to be shaped for entrance into mass commercial society and for jobs in factories and clerical work. Students are expected to receive ideas, the public school systems, not to wrestle or come up with them, and to internalize what they learn for the remainder of their adult lives. When students sit patiently as learnings are dictated to them and they're asked to memorize and regurgitate them by rote, it doesn't strike us as odd as so long as the learnings are in math, biology, English, or American history. But all you have to do is change the material to Kim Il-sung thought and you see the problem. During the rocky course of the Enlightenment in the 18th century, primary schools and universities reintroduced a revolutionary idea, critical thinking. This was indeed a reintroduction, not an invention, as the Socratic method of teaching by asking questions and learning by pulling together different answers from different people was already 1,000 years old. So they valued intellectual exchange, in which all views, even those so-called authorities, were subjected to serious analysis and painstaking critical interrogation. Okay, so let me scoot this over here. So, man, I really like that page. All right, so how many parents in America today can recognize their tradition of critical thinking in their children's classrooms? In many American schools and universities, it is no longer acceptable to allow different ideas to compete with or openly challenge one another. Disfavored speakers are often haggled, ridiculed, and silenced during educational events, to the point that many schools have started to cancel appearances by guest speakers and lecturers for fear of safety and security breaches, a development that smacks of the Dark Ages. It's difficult for people born here to understand just how radical an idea it really is. Congress, so she's talking about the First Amendment. Congress shall make no laws respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise therefore, or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people peacefully to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. That sentence is the very heart of freedom, a prism of cultural and political achievement, the likes of which I never thought possible for human beings not only to write on paper, to make the very law under which hundreds of millions of individuals would live. In reality, of course, Columbia's safe space was elite code language for restrictions on ideological heterogeneity. It meant a place where to invert the phrase popularized by Ben Shapiro, feelings don't care about your facts. I started to despair that my institutional home would not be a vehicle to search for truth, but an opposite, a cult, but the opposite, a cult. She felt like she was in a cult at Columbia University. So I love her compassion, though, because of where she came from. She understood the power of brainwashing, the power of propaganda, the power to be confused about what is really real and true. And she said that she, when she's speaking of her fellow classmates, she said, I could see the real suffering. They weren't faking it. They were in pain. They truly felt threatened, harmed, and oppressed. I actually sympathized. I remembered as a child being so brainwashed by my teachers that I sincerely believed the dear leader could read my mind. And when you're in that place, you don't know how to break out of it. And that's where we're at. We're having to help people understand that they've believed lies. They've been told lies. And it's really hard to go against that narrative, especially even here in Abilene, Texas, you know, to challenge the status quo. You're shamed. You know, I was thinking of this picture, like that, you know, that we in Abilene, there's an approved idea and people circle the wagons and they all get around the idea or the person or whoever's the one you're supposed to follow and you're supposed to get in line with. And anyone who is not a part of that circle is on the out, and you're wrong, and you will be shamed, and you will be eviscerated by people in the circle, not necessarily the person in the middle of the circle, the one presenting ideas. It's all the people in the circle who will take on the role of making sure that the person who disagrees or presents an alternative way of thinking is silenced. And it's scary. And I'm not saying we're to the North Korea scary, but I'm saying it even happens here in Abilene, Texas, and the big country. And it's really sobering once you realize it and recognize that groupthink is a powerful contagion for keeping people in line and keeping things in the status quo, which I don't ever think is fine. Even if the status quo is satisfactory, we should never allow that kind of way of living to prosper, because groupthink is destructive, even if we're benefiting from it. I mean it when I say that all I felt for this person, so she's again talking about a person who was very confused, compassion, empathy, and understanding. I couldn't blame them for being so severed from reality. They felt entitled to talk to me as if I were a bigot when I was just a very recent immigrant who made a mistake. She's talking about when she called somebody by the wrong pronoun. According to what I'd been taught, it wasn't really a mistake. The person was simply lost, completely untethered from life, with no sense whatsoever of either justice or injustice meant or looked like, and it probably wasn't even their fault. So I think it says quite literally, she had to be taught to reason. I remember when she was in our classroom learning, by the way, she completed middle school and high school all after the age of 16. She never quit, never let her circumstances define her, and she powered through and amazing. But she had to be taught. And she said the thing she hated most about school in South Korea was they would say, what is your favorite color? And she's like, I don't know. Tell me what I need to. I mean, to even ask her opinion was painful. Excruciatingly painful, where she didn't even want to go to class because she didn't know how to think for herself because she'd never been told that she could. And it took a while for her to figure that out. So she said, that's why the subversion of critical thinking is so dangerous. It is the mechanism by which humans lose the faculties as individuals and succumb to groupthink, which is a precondition for every totalitarian society on earth, and which ultimately failed her father. Her father went to prison and never came back the same. He was crushed. He was a shell of the man that he used to be. And it was hard to read because knowing who he was before he went in and how he was so fearful of ever being discovered and found out, it was really hard. So the U.S. military has an acronym for this. It's called VUCA. It stands for volatility, uncertainty, complexity, and ambiguity. Tyrannical regimes understand the confusion of life under VUCA. The first tax is to simplify life for their subjects, often through a fictional narrative. So if you can give people a simplified life, they'll take it because it's easier than complex, hard lives that you have to fight for. She says many of her fellow students at Columbia were suffering on their own version of VUCA. Columbia professors seem to be primarily engaged in their own version of autocratic simplification. Feel tired, stressed, and a little frightened of the future? It's because the system is rigged about you. It was built by white men in order to subjugate you. Only by destroying that system will you finally find peace, security, and confidence. So then she got to go to speak at Daily Beast. She snubbed Jeff Bezos in the beginning and realized it, but she went and was speaking amongst all these greats. She said like Meryl Streep, Jon Stewart, Hillary Rodham Clinton. It was a Women of the World conference. That's what it was. She says, this conference was a watershed moment for me and my understanding of the world. Until that point, I thought that the international community had neglected to do anything for the North Korean people because they didn't know what was going on there. After all, only about 200 North Korean defectors had made it to America legally in the past 70 plus years, and no one inside North Korea can communicate with the outside world. So she just thought they didn't know. It turned out that the purpose of the conference, like the Women in the World, was not to mobilize financial capital and political power among people who are fortunate enough to possess it in order to help people suffering in places like China and North Korea. It was, if there was any point at all, to passionately discuss the suffering of women in America. What a hard pill to swallow that you know what's going on in the rest of the world, and here they are talking about Americans suffering. So she's talking about Hillary Clinton here. She met her and talked to her, and she said, but if with her political ambitions thwarted the following year of being president, you'd think nothing to do but administer the massive funds of the nonprofit Clinton Foundation and use her considerable, I wasn't supposed to read that, but she didn't do anything. Hillary Clinton did absolutely nothing to help her and her plight. Okay, so now we're to chapter 4, the hypocrisy of the elite. The book is commonly misread. The rise of meritocracy is what she's talking about, as an attack on merit rather than the prophecy of a class of educated technocratic elites who seize power and wield it at the expense of ordinary people who can never hope to join their ranks. Okay. Let's see here if that's the rest of that. No, it's not. All right. So yeah, this is back to Hillary Clinton. I got these out of order a little. Ever since she mentioned her experience with North Korea to Hillary Rodham Clinton, she's never seen her mentioned the atrocities suffered by North Korean women, not even once, which is terrible. So it took a long time for her to start thinking for herself rather than with the boundaries set for her. She was crippled by the expectation that even every thought I had to make decisions and think for myself. It was crippling to her. She started to believe, and she still does now, that the only way to think for yourself is to ignore the mainstream media and largely forget the daily news cycle and connect instead with the great minds of the past who know all about our problems better than we do ourselves. This is the reason why the great book of Western civilization are all banned in dictatorships, which means the definition of banned means you have no access to it. You can't buy it. You can't find it. You can't check it out at the library. You can't read it. It's illegal. It's banned. That doesn't mean that a public entity decides to not house every book on its shelf, especially in terms of how we protect the hearts and minds of children. Just free information there. So she says, I, little O Yonomi from Haesan, would speak to the world's movers and shakers, the one who determined great events with people, people with real influence and power, which is what I needed access to if I was ever going to do good. And here they all were, amassed in one building on the Pacific coast, the Pacific Ocean, on the other side of which were the people I wanted to help. I was sure I would. So she wanted to help. And I think this is the campfire. So the only way to I found to stay sane is to try my best to derive meaning from the good fortune and what I've chosen to do with it. I know how blessed I am and that my freedom wasn't earned. I'm not smarter or tougher than others who fought for their freedom and come up short. In some moments, I see it as pure luck. In others, I feel that someone above dealt me this hand and expects me to do something with it beyond enjoying myself. He expects me not only to count my blessings and share them. And she talks about the opulence of riding in this private jet with Henry Weinstein and just all the people that she met and how everybody was so excited for what she was meeting. And she realized that she was trying to do good and they didn't care one bit. It was America that made this story possible. This is Henry Weinstein she's talking about. The land of opportunity where was anyone who was willing to work hard, persevere, could see even a nobody from Flushing, Queens, the son of a Polish immigrant, even dirt poor refugees from North Korea who barely succeed. It was America that made the stories possible. By then, I gathered that this, when I reached out to one of the people I met at Campfire and asked if she'd known about his Weinstein's behavior before it became public, she said, of course she knew, everyone did. But by the way they treated him, he was a perfect gentleman who never abused women or did all the horrible things he did. And that's where she saw this disconnect. Okay, so when she got up and spoke about her life in North Korea and China, it was not the speech they were expecting. I could see the looks of disbelief and sheer horror on the faces of many of those present. Jeff Bezos, for his part, looked to be in tears. After I was done speaking, the audience ventured a unanimous but uncertain applause. Bezos raised his hand and asked the question that I still remember vividly. What kept you going at all odds and convinced you not to give up hope? Seeing his tears and those of the crowd, I struggled to choke back tears too. My father, she said. My father told me my life is a gift and worth fighting for no matter what. Even on his deathbed, he smiled at me and told me how precious life was and asked me never give up fighting for life. I relayed that my father's simple lesson was the only reason I was on stage speaking to them that morning because throughout my life, choosing to continue living has been the hardest choice of all. The single most effective thing they could do to raise awareness about the Communist Party sponsorship of modern-day Holocaust in North Korea and about the modern-day slave trade of North Korea and China, that is what they needed to do. But she was a naive little girl who didn't understand the complexity, or they viewed her like she'd come from another galaxy with no idea the complexity or importance of China and their livelihoods. Their interest in me simply receded as did. So I'm sorry, I'm stumbling through this, but she didn't understand that they couldn't give up their life because that would mean giving up. They couldn't intervene for her or the millions of people in China being suffering or North Korea because it would cost them their opulence in society in relationship to their business success. Okay, so many of the people who appeared to listen intently as I told them what they could do to make a difference in the world instead spent their time warning the nation incessantly about the fascists in the White House, of Russian puppets in the Oval Office, of white nationalists putting babies in cages. They advocated against truth in media in the neutral application of law, which they no longer regard as democratic norms, but as unaffordable luxuries in the face of an existential threat, a president they didn't vote for. So all the troubles of the world took the second seat to having somebody they didn't vote for in office. I just tell you, I guess I really love books because I am struggling to finish this in one podcast, which makes it more interesting. But a lot of times I'm not even sure if people follow up with the second one, but I really feel like to honor your time and to keep you from turning away at my super long podcast. I'm going to pause this book here because the second half is so important. I don't want to rush through it. And I want you to be able to hear with the great detail of what she expresses and why it's so important to us living here in Abilene, Texas, in the Bug Country. So stay tuned for the next part. Please subscribe and share this podcast with your family and friends so that we can get the word about how they can understand what's going on and how to be culturally relevant to the issues of the day and how we approach them. And that would help me out a bunch, because I know that I can't have this conversation individually with people, and we want to make sure people know what's going on and how we approach the challenges we're facing here in our own little part of the world. And so until part two, enjoy the rest of your week.